If you haven't been into the Speakers Forum before at the Green Gathering, welcome. This is a really good space. We get to hear from loads of different people. It's a real privilege, actually, to loads of different people who are involved in areas of policy or who are on the front line doing activism. And now we're going to have Tony Gosling talking to us about propaganda. Tony is a journalist and broadcaster. He's well known to this tent. He is a faithful contributor in this setting. So I'm going to hand over to him. Great.
Fine, I think, yeah.
And we will have questions at the end, I'm pretty sure. So do start thinking about your questions.
Hello. Okay, well, thanks for staying after all those temptations to leave and talk to all the leaders of the Green Party. My name's Tony Gosling. I've come along to these Green gatherings every year, partly because I'm based in Bristol and it's very easy for me to nip out on a Saturday after we do our weekly current affairs radio programme in Bristol every Friday evening. And also because the broadcasting we do in Bristol, I think, is connected in with what this festival's about in a way, because, for example, last week we did recorded a programme which is going to be broadcast next Tuesday with a guy called Timothy Herford. You've probably never heard of Tim, but he's a singer-songwriter, ex-stand-up comic, gardener, and they have a band in Bristol called the Transpersonals. And we had what I love to do, which is a fascinating conversation about the history of festivals in Britain and our ability as a people in a democratic country to actually organise our own affairs. And what we'll be hearing after my talk's finished is about Pitchford, which is where you've got the secret state, effectively, police, security services, interfering with our right to self-organise. So if we want to get together a movement to change things, it would be nice to be able to do that, like Phoenix we were hearing from earlier on. You know, this is the attempt to open up more space for people, public spaces, affordable homes, to transform our environment. Because what we've got, and I really want to follow on from that housing talk we've just had, because I actually did have my hand up, and because I'm the next speaker, I've got a slight advantage in that I can actually say what I was going to say. And that is, the housing crisis is very simple, really, it seems to me, is you've got a totally failing economic system. Well, it's not failing, it's under attack. It's being destroyed. Since 2008, we had the biggest heist in history. The Western financial elite decided that they were going to do false accounting for a few years, and then they were going to threaten Gordon Brown, which is what they did, and various other leaders around the Western world. They said, basically, they were like suicide bombers in the room with the politicians. And they said, well, either you bail us out, or the entire financial system is going west tonight, tomorrow. And the cash points will all stop, and no one will be able to take any money out, and everyone will be pointing the finger at you. So, bail us out. And although Gordon Brown said afterwards, with a little Freudian slip, I saved the world, actually entirely the opposite was true. He has screwed things up permanently. We've now got a financial system which is heading down the tubes very fast. If you look at our national debt, I did a little, there's an article from a couple of years ago in the Telegraph about this. What is our real national debt? It's actually far, far more than we're being told. At the moment, it's going up officially at $200 billion a year. So the national debt going up at $200 billion a year, and it's going up faster and faster all the time. So there's obviously nothing being done about trying to stop the deficit. The real figure, if I can find it in here, is horrific. It's far, far worse. It's something like three times. This is how inefficient I am, I'm afraid, having to flick through here to try and find the figures. Here we go. The article was the 20th of August 2010, and it's the headline was Government Urged to Reveal the True National Debt of $4.8 trillion. The Institute of Economic Affairs, the IEA, calculated the national debt is $4.8 trillion once state and public sector person pension liabilities are also included, or £78,000 for every person in the UK. So every time you hear the figure $1.5 trillion, I think you just have to, I mean, if you extend it to today, that article, in 2010 when the article was written, the official debt was $1.2 trillion. Unofficially, it was 4.8 trillion. Now, in 2016, the official debt is 1.7 trillion. Unofficially, 6.8 trillion. So it's going up and up and up at a skyrocketing rate, and the bankers just love it because it's more and more excuse for QE, quantitative easing, printing money, which goes to them and not to us. And they're getting richer and richer and richer all the time. Now, as a result of all this, you've got bubbles, housing bubble and stock market bubble, right? So the reason we've got a housing crisis is largely because those two bubbles are traditional places for people to invest. Housing is actually much safer than the stock market. The stock market can just go down, as we learned in 1929, just like that, and it nearly did in 2008. So investors are now increasingly looking to put their money into housing as safer than the stock market, and certainly much better than and leaving it in a bank, because interest rates are heading towards negative interest rates. So the idea is people who are investing are being sort of shifted around in great tens of millions, if there are tens of millions of people with large amounts of money, I suppose there are, from one way of investing, one place to put their money, and it's ending up towards housing as the safest bet in a fragile world where, say, an attack in the Middle East could end up stopping the oil supply to the West, and then everything would just crash down. So people are aware of this, that it is very fragile. The system is very fragile. And as a result, more and more housing is vital. We just had a piece of news this week, I think it was The Guardian reported it, that we have the lowest rate of home ownership in 30 years. So people don't own their own homes. What's happening is the investors are coming in, buy-to-let landlords. We all know there's a crisis. I would say the solution, as we were talking about right at the end of the previous talk, is what we're doing in Bristol. It's pretty simple. It's called BAM, Bristol Housing Action Movement, and we get together every Monday evening, and we put people who need housing together with existing groups. Sometimes people come along for a few weeks, they meet people that they get on with, and then they'll start a new squat of some sort. Because a lot of this land and housing and property that people are investing in is empty. And so you've got, really, I mean, you're an entrepreneur, aren't you? You need somewhere to live. There's all this empty housing. Move in. This is largely, I mean, quite often you'll get a few weeks in there. Sometimes you get a heavy landlord of some sort. But what you're doing is you're saying, well, here's a need. Here's a surplus. Let's just take advantage of it. And the other thing is, I mean, I was squatting for 2 years in one place, which was beautiful, and had just been done up by the Housing Association, and didn't pay a penny rent all the time. The first thing we did was just turned on the, started paying for the electricity, the water, and all that stuff. And that's all we paid for 2 years in a beautiful place. So there is an opportunity for entrepreneurs out there to get together with others at places like our Bristol Housing Action, get tooled up with things like the Squatters Handbook from this, the Advisory Service for Squatters. And the fact of the matter is, and I've done both private renting and, I mean, a housing association place now, and squatting. And the squatting was actually, not all the time, but quite often, it was more safe and more permanent than the private renting. Absolutely crazy situation where we're living in now. And so there, I think, is, you know, we just simply have to go around the system. And of course, it's much nicer not having to pay anything for your rent when you're squatting. So anyway, that's just really what I wanted to say, kind of to tail off the previous talk. But in a way, that analysis I've just given you there about the national debt and what's going on with the economy and the bankers being like suicide bombers in the room with the politicians in 2008 is the sort of stuff we're not really getting analysis of in our mainstream journalism, particularly not in financial journalism. There is one guy who's a freelance writer called Ian Fraser, who you can find online. He writes for the Scottish Sunday Herald and I think the Herald in Glasgow. And he's one of the only journalist I've ever come across who writes honestly about the financial system. And he came on our radio show in Bristol a few years ago, and it said, well, look, all these financial journalists, they're just in the pocket of the city, so they just write whatever the city wants. In fact, you'll find this increasingly in London, because people don't necessarily twig this. It doesn't happen in all countries, but here in Britain, all of our national news and all of our international news comes from London. Everything. We don't have regional... The Guardian newspaper started in Manchester, right, as a regional, national and international outlet, but it then moved to London. So I think this is one of the models that I'd like to see expanding around the country, is we need to have better regional journalism talking about national and international affairs. So that's what we do in Bristol on the radio every week for 2 hours. Current affairs, we have a politician in for the first hour, have a chat with them through the local national stories, and then we do more out there stuff in the second hour, more investigative journalism. For example, last night I was very pleased during the week to get a call from the father of someone called Tom Hayes. Tom was imprisoned this time last year, exactly a year ago, for 14 years for conspiracy to commit fraud with the LIBOR fraud. Well, he was a trader. He was just simply following orders. Effectively, he was doing what he was told as part of his job. And because he didn't fit in with the other traders, he wasn't a coke snorting, alcohol imbibing, wild kind of crazy guy who would do absolutely anything to make money. He was just a kind of ordinary chap. He was singled out. He was scapegoated for the LIBOR fraud. And so it's quite nice that Nick Hayes, his father, actually contacted me and said, look, I want to come on the radio and talk about what's happened to Tom, because I've been trying through the London media for a year to get this story out. We did a similar thing with the London Olympics 4 years ago. Of course, the Olympics are going on. Just the opening ceremony started last night. It was quite impressive at midnight, watching it on the telly. But what's the Olympics about? The Olympics seems to me to be about an opportunity for world leaders. Putin's not there, apparently. To get together, to have quiet chats about the way they want to sort the world out for themselves, to work for them, not for us. Behind the scenes, whilst they watch a whole bunch of performing acrobats show just how strong and tough and fast they are. So this is about a kind of, it's not an intellectual exercise, it's a physical exercise. So physical prowess is all that's important, not intellectual prowess, or not the ability to deconstruct what's going on around you. That doesn't matter. And as if by magic, Nick Hayes, who was on the radio with me last night, he used to be the editor of a program some of you might remember called World in Action. He's based in Manchester. His son just so happened to be the trader who was scapegoated for LIBOR. And he explained to us the way that this was a quite fragile ecosystem that they were running in the 1970s and 1980s. He was the editor in 1990s. He worked for Current Affairs at the BBC, then went over to Channel 4 Dispatches. So there really isn't any proper investigative journalism going on in London anymore. Maybe a little bit in the newspapers. So we're there in Bristol in a way to kind of capture the people who've tried to get through to the media in London, hit a brick wall, and then they come and have a chat to us. As this chap Ben Fellows did back 4 years ago, when he was training to be a security guard for the London Olympics, he then found that there wasn't any proper real security going to be happening at the London Olympics. In other words, things like the torches that they used to scan people were going to be switched off. They were only going to actually really check one in five people as they came through the turnstiles. This kind of stuff he was being told about. He came on the radio, talked about it, and we then had a sort of break. I sent this information. I said, I can't verify what he's saying, but I sent it to the MPs, I sent it to the police, etc., and to the army. And then I heard back, 2 weeks afterwards, I was driving back from Weston-super-Mare to Bristol, and on the radio, we pulled over. I couldn't believe it. 3,500 troops being drafted in to take over from G4S because they're not up to the job. Yeah. And then the week after, another 1,500. So they had 5,000 soldiers take over from G4S. And I'm not saying that our story was why that happened, but it was part of why it happened, that we were able to broadcast that in Bristol, distribute it around the internet. It went viral online. And when you shove it in the front of the faces of the people who have got to make these decisions, if anything goes wrong, they're aware. And I made sure all those people confirmed that they'd received that interview and the copy of it. So this is what I'm saying is effectively you're dealing with a very propagandized system in London, akin to the Soviets. I'd just like to see a show of hands. How many people here regularly watch and listen to the news? Stick your hand up if you do. Yeah. So that's about maybe 40%, something like that. Now, there's a reason for that. It's because most of what we're being told is nonsense. In one way or another, I mean, there's half-truths being told, and it's really dispiriting. I don't know if you find it like that. If you, when I'm just driving down here today, you hear something, you think, that's rubbish. They're just talking nonsense. Let's just take one example, and I'll ask maybe in a minute, have a think to yourselves, if you can think of other examples, of something that comes onto the TV or the radio, and you think that's just nonsense. I mean, in a way, it's a bit like we were told as children the Soviet Union was supposed to be like, wasn't it? So people get told lies, but then they kind of read between the lines, and they know what's really going on anyway, so the lines are almost pointless. And that kind of comes back to the title of my talk originally, which was a quote from George Orwell. And I don't, maybe people may know George Orwell worked for the BBC in Bush House for the World Service in the Second World War. And about halfway through the World War II, I think it was about 1943, something like that, he wrote his resignation letter because he'd been working for the Indian Service, broadcasting to India. And he wrote them a very polite letter saying, I'm actually doing you a favour by resigning because this propaganda isn't working. And I think that's where we are now here in Britain, is that there are attempts to convince people of things and it's not necessarily actually getting any traction. It's just under a year since Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party. And I think it's pretty fair to say we've seen almost wall-to-wall propaganda from the London media against Corbyn. We have Laura Koonsberg at the BBC, the political editor, making lots of kind of biased statements against Corbyn, looking for sort of holes to pick in him. I actually think Corbyn is, we're told again and again, aren't we, that he's unelectable, right? Now, this is totally the opposite of the truth. This is what you might call a kind of psyop, psychological warfare. The thing is, the ruling elite are scared to death of Corbyn being electable and being elected. So what they do is they put out the lie, he's unelectable. For example, our local MP in Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy, she's one of the coup people who's decided Jeremy Corbyn's no good. Kerry has just had her local party vote to endorse Corbyn. So the people that fought to get her elected went out on the doorsteps and banged on doors, who fought to get Kerry in as an MP, and she's now taken against this leader. They've endorsed him as a leader. So what's going on with her? What is she doing? She's completely ignoring the people who got her elected in the first place. Something peculiar is happening in the Labour Party. She actually came on our... she won't come on our radio show. Yeah, we're getting the omerta, like the mafia, from all of these coup MPs. They will not come on speak on the radio with us. So what I have to do is pinch their speeches on the BBC and various other places that they do speeches. I find them online and just rebroadcast them. Then we can discuss what she's saying here. One of the things she said is Corbyn is a cult-like figure. Right, hang on a minute. A cult-like figure. Right, what are you saying there? That he's like a guru in some cult? This is actually really despicable for an MP that's supposed to be part of the same party to call her party leader that's been elected by the membership a cult-like figure. Very strange thing to say. And even more strange propaganda put out by Kerry was his heart's not in it. This is psychological warfare, right? Actually, Kerry, it's your heart that's not in it, yeah? And you're afraid that his heart is in it and that people can see that, so you're just lying to the public on the BBC to talk about this stuff. Anyway, if you saw Owen Smith launching leadership bid against Jeremy Corbyn, Kerry McCarthy, our local MP, was stood behind him. And she looked very, very sort of sad and morose, which I thought, well, you know, sure, this is the guy you think is going to be elected. Anyway, so the Labour Party is not the only political party at the moment which seems to have some kind of psychological warfare going on within it to disrupt it. I phoned up Thursday lunchtime BBC Cardiff to say, are you broadcasting the first of these debates that's going on in Cardiff tonight with your BBC person chairing it? And they said, oh, no, we're not. So it's happening with the BBC chair in Cardiff, and it's the first of the leadership debates between Owen Smith and Jeremy Corbyn. But the BBC are not broadcasting it on radio or on television. Actually, I think it was News 24 or something broadcast it. But I find that extraordinary. If the BBC we pay for is sitting there in Cardiff with all these transmitters and, you know, we've got the future of the country at stake here, don't you think it would be nice to broadcast that? So people, and actually, it was a damn good debate. And if anyone gets back home and you want to get online, it is online. And we broadcast some excerpts from it last night. But you've got the audience reaction is extremely powerful to certain things that various of them are saying. And you get a real good sense of, hey, something's at stake here, folks. It's our future. Which you don't get in some of the way that these things are presented in a pre-recorded way and sanitised by people like Channel 4 News or whoever. So there's, a tremendous amount of propaganda going down out there. I see the media, call me a bit of a hippie if you want, but I see the media as the nervous system of humanity, particularly broadcast media and radio. Which is why I want to be in there, because this is where many of the problems are that have stopped us sorting ourselves out as a species. So stopped us housing ourselves, stopped having the proper system of organising our power and our energy and this obsession with oil. Just one thing I'd just like to take as an example of that is some of the research that I was doing when I left the BBC, which I was working for in the early 1990s in London and Wiltshire and Southampton. I was doing some research on the closure of the railways in the 1960s. Now, if you go all over this country, you'll find these heritage railways everywhere with these little chuffer trains going backwards and forwards. And in a way, it was a miracle that it happened when it did, because we wouldn't have those heritage railways if it had happened at another stage where steam was just being, you know, kind of phased out in the 60s at the same time as Beeching closed the railways down. But the thing is, why did that happen at that particular time? And I think many of us are suspicious when we sit in a traffic jam on a motorway, or when I have to drive down here. I'd much rather hop on the train in Bristol and come down to Chepstow and walk up or whatever, or get a taxi and a bus. Why do I have to drive everywhere? It really annoys me. Well, the reason is pretty simple. If you look into it, you'll see the way that this entire nightmare of all the people dying on our roads. We had, for example, in London when I was a youngster in the 1980s, something called Fares Fair, where Ken Livingstone, who was the mayor at the time, what he did, and I was going to school, and I found suddenly one day I was going to school and my bus ticket was cheaper than it was the day before. I think it was 5p and it went down to 3.5p. I thought, this is weird. But anyway, it was a real challenge to our preconceptions about the way we get around. And I think Livingstone, what he did also was he and Dave Wetzel introduced something called the travel card, which we now assume to use in London, where you can use lots of different, you know, forms of transport on one card. Now, they fought like crazy, the Labour group and the GLC at the time, to get that stuff in. But the main point I'm trying to make here is not about the price. It's about the decrease in the accidents across London was amazing. In the first year, there were 800 less serious accidents on the roads in London. And this was just the first year. And it was only really allowed to run for about a year or 2 years before it was stopped by the House of Lords. It was actually my local council, Bromley Council, that took them to court and stopped it. But you see, what you had there was a real challenge to the orthodoxy of ways of thinking about transport. And the reason we've got this orthodoxy about using cars all the time and polluting our environment and driving into people is it actually starts in the late 1950s. Because in the late 50s, there was oil exploration going on. Now, these oil companies, right, I'm sure there's nobody in this room that's a fan of oil companies, but what they were doing was a bit like the kind of Knights Templar in medieval times, right? So they explore, they find things, they don't tell anyone, and they sit down, right, what are we going to do with this? And we're not going to let anybody know about it. And they were doing exactly the same with oil. They probably still are to this day. When they do their seismographic surveys, they don't tell anybody what they're finding and where the oil is. They also release officially in their annual report where they known oil reserves are, but they don't. That doesn't necessarily have any real link to reality. You are just trusting the oil company, and you're a fool if you do as to where those oil reserves. We may have loads of oil reserves under here. They may know, but we won't. So anyway, they discovered all this oil in the North Sea in the 1950s. And the point being there, let's exploit that. Let's exploit that oil. But how are we going to do it? Well, the British government wanted to help the oil companies to do it, because they were going to get all the revenue from the oil. But the Americans didn't like it. Because what would happen if we started drilling oil in the North Sea? The price would go down. The world oil price, right? So if the Brits start drilling all this oil out of the North Sea, it's going to depress the world oil price. Oh, we can't have that. So they said, well, okay, so we will help you financially, because the city wouldn't help. The Americans would help the oil companies financially to build these rigs, etc. But only if we opened up a big domestic market for oil. And so that's what beaching was really all about. So by closing the railways down, that meant that people, oh dear, we're going to have to buy cars. It brought there's a kind of myth, and I ought to scotch this really, that the railways weren't affordable and that they weren't making any money, blah, blah. Right, well, we're subsidising them massively much more than we ever have before now. But that was a lie too, because the railways, there's a guy called Ted Gibbons, who's a former manager, finance manager in British Rail, pre-British Rail even. I think, he was in British Rail in the 1950s and 60s. And he's saying, well, we wanted to put some of the prices up, we weren't allowed to. Our price structure in the 50s and 60s for railways was totally regulated by the government. They wouldn't let you. And so that shortfall in the railway money was all due to government regulation. So the government said, oh, we're... Anyway, so they brought in this guy Beeching to do the job. Now, does anybody know anything about his history? Who was this Dr. Beeching that closed our railways down? Yes, sir. In fact, you're partly right. Most people would say he was from ICI, which was a very important, powerful company, private company, because it was producing all the explosives in World War II. So it was a strategically very national security important company. But he was a nuclear scientist. He was working on the British atomic bomb project, Fort Halstead in the North Downs. And who uncovered this is a guy called Richard Cottrell, who was a former Tory MEP who used to write for the British Aircraft Corporation, do their magazine. And Richard dug out loads of stuff about Beeching, which he'd found out through people that knew him personally, etc., about him being a metallurgist. So they brought this metallurgist from the Atomic Bomb Project and from ICI in to look at the accounts of the railways. Well, he'd be like me looking at the accounts. He didn't know one balance sheet from a spreadsheet from anything else. He had no idea what he was doing. But he was a front man, effectively, for this close down. And the other thing about all this, of course, is it followed the Nazi model, right? Now, that might sound a bit shocking to some, but it was the Nazis that really introduced these autobahns. They had this idea they wanted everybody to have their own form of transport. They didn't like public transport. So autobahns, we had the freeways in the US, and then we had in the 60s, they started building motorways here. So this was a program decided by somebody from the oil industry, from the energy sector, and it was all to do with controlling governments. That is to do through saying, well, you're going to be dependent on this oil revenue, and also us, because we have to keep going back to the petrol companies to buy oil if we want to get around. There is no such kind of public provision. So back to the propaganda. Now, let's talk about the more modern stuff. This is one of the things I think there's a real attempt out there, right, to bamboozle us and bombard us with so much information that we haven't got we're not able to keep on top of it, right? I think that's what's going on. If you get lies after lies after lies, night after night, day after day, you eventually think, oh God, I've had enough of this. This is a psychological tool to disengage people, right? So all I'd say is, don't necessarily watch the BBC, listen to the BBC or the news or whatever, but at least once every couple of weeks, go onto a good website, download a good podcast, like ours, of course, I'd say that, and just get up to speed with some of the stuff that's going on. The Turkish coup, for example, a few weeks ago. This is really massive. massive, and it's not been looked at by any kind of main documentaries. None of the news channels have looked at it. Would anyone like to share with us what they think about that? Who's been checking out what's been happening in Turkey? Because it's enormous. Anyone? Yeah?
I know there's like they're shutting down most science, like education institutes, a lot of scientists have lost their jobs.
Right. Loads of arrests. Absolutely right. I wonder where they've got those lists of names of people to arrest from in Turkey. Now, you know, the Turkish Zaman newspaper a few months ago was closed down. The police just swarmed into the building, closed it down. Turkey. But the thing is, the reason why is, it, is someone over there have a something to say as well about Turkey?
Aren't they saying that? Well, Erdogan's saying that it's all these fundamentalist Islamic groups that they wanted to keep down, but is that like a cover to get all these things put away?
Well. Yes, it could be. Yeah, I mean, there's a really good article out there. I'm not sure who wrote it. I remember reading it about a week after the coup, saying this is Erdogan's Reichstag fire, right? So it's an excuse to clamp down on everything, right? But there's also a lot of other interpretations of what's happening. All I'll say is what I've picked up and what I think is going on over there is about 2 weeks before the coup attempt. There was a fulsome apology by the Turkish government about shooting down a Russian jet last year, right? So there's a kind of, it seems, a rapprochement going on between Turkey and Russia a few weeks before the coup attempt. And look, you can't underestimate how important Turkey is. It's at the eastern fringes of NATO, right next door to the Russians and the Caucasus, right? Number one. Number two, it's an Islamic country and it's in NATO. Whereas NATO seems to be at war with Islam in a lot of other countries. So it's all sorts of problems with keeping, I think, what's happened here effectively. And just looking at through all the articles and all the analysis, particularly when the NATO airbase Interlik was surrounded by Turkish soldiers, which has apparently got 40 nuclear weapons on that base, American nukes. And if the Turks are surrounding that nuclear weapon base and they're saying, hang on, guys, you're going to have to do what you're told now, and then switching the power off to the Americans. Now, I imagine those Americans have got some emergency generators, right? But what's happening here is the Turks are thinking about switching sides. They're thinking about switching from being on the side of NATO to being on the side of Russia. And there may be good reasons for that, you know? So we're not getting, do you see what I'm saying? We're not getting this analysis, really, in our mainstream press. It's all, oh, a terrible coup attempt. One of the things which was a real sure sign, because when it happened Friday evening, and they always happen Friday evenings, right, have you noticed? Because all the news media go home for 2 days, right? Pretty much all, and you just get a skeleton staff unable to deal with these things. Also, stock markets close. So if there's going to be a crash, it'll happen on a Friday evening, or a coup, it's going to happen on a Friday evening, which is where our show is on a Friday evening. We actually ran, we ran a spoof one Friday saying it's just been announced that they're instituting exchange controls in Britain, that 40 top bankers have been arrested and blah, blah, blah. And quite a lot of people believed it, you know. So just in a way, it's a bit like what we were doing was a bit like the whole... What was it called in the mid 1930s with Orson Welles? War of the Worlds, yeah. But the opposite. So here's a not a scary scenario. Here's a great scenario. This is an interesting and an amazing, wonderful thing potentially. Exchange controls would basically stop people taking their money out, corporations, etc., that are in Britain, that are always threatening to take their money out. They say no, you can't, because we've just instituted exchange controls. You've got to keep your money in Britain, huh? Not quite, no. It would have been nice. A few people did enjoy it. Yeah. Anyway, we got some very positive feedback about that. But, you know, this is one of the things you can do with financial, once you're on top of what the financial system is trying to do to us. So, okay, lies, big lies. This is what it's all about, I think, is that there's this groupthink with enormous lies that have been told again and again and again and again. Let's go back, to the 12th century, the Crusades. Anyone heard of Prester John? Prester John was a lie told by the Vatican which was about a whole load of Christians who were the other side of the Holy Land, who were fighting to try and link up with us, right? And it was just a load of rubbish. But the Vatican put it out all across Europe, this letter from Prester John, and he was supposed to be a king living in this wonderful Christian kingdom, and they just were trying to crush the Muslims from the other side. And this went out around the nobles of Europe, and they suddenly looked at this old Prester John, we need to help him. Yeah, so they joined the Crusades. And they went down. These people got on their horses to try and help Prester John. Prester John never existed. So this is not a new concept, right? maybe. Anyway, so there are some interpretations saying, oh, Prester John might have been this guy or this guy. It wasn't. It was. And also, once they realised that they'd gone over to that part of the world and Prester John wasn't there, then Prester John shifted. He moved. The Vatican moved him across the world to another part of the world. I think South America. But anyhow, so this is a big lie territory. We also had the big lies of Hitler, didn't we? Of this Jewish conspiracy, for example, trying to control the planet. Well, what about ISIS? ISIS, isn't that our big lie of today? We've got this guy who's there's talk about him running as Trump's vice president. He's called General Michael Flynn. He was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in the United States up until about a year ago. He retired. Michael Flynn is saying the creation of ISIS was a willful decision of the White House. We told them, yeah, if you do this, then ISIS will, yeah. And then they did it anyway. So what he's saying is this is effectively part of US policy. ISIS, the creation of ISIS, is part of US policy, Pentagon policy. So, I mean, you know, we're not really getting that on the BBC. And also, then you see... Well, I think it is true. Just a minute. Let me say another thing about ISIS, right? And that is that we have photographs of Israeli medics treating ISIS injured soldiers and film of it too. So if the Israelis are helping ISIS and the Americans were involved in creating ISIS, this is a big lie we're being told about ISIS. There is obviously some nutters over there who are, I think, they're part of, they're sort of, shall we say, trying to make a name for themselves. There has been a big effort. Now, you mentioned the fundamentalist Turks, the Gulenist movement, right? Which is this guy who used to be in Turkey, he's now in the US. He's got a tremendous amount of money and he's running these Gulenist schools over in the US, which are teaching a version of Islam, which is not dissimilar to the Wahhabism, which the Saudis have been funding since the end of the Second World War. So you've got this kind of fanatical version, a little bit like the, I don't know, maybe like the Jehovah's Witnesses or something, you know, the cult versions of Christianity, where you're setting up a crazed version of your religion in order to have a religious war in the future. So that's, I think, what ISIS is all about. And these people, they think that they're doing something for Allah, whatever, but actually they're just kind of, they want they want to do something about the situation in the world, and they are being steered down that road to think that they are going to fulfill the great prophecies of the Quran, you know. So this is a trick, a really simple trick, a bit like the trick played on Gordon Brown. Look, sign here and let's have a massive bailout, you know. Anyway, so what I'm painting a picture of here, I suppose, is of forces behind the scenes who are, maybe have been there for centuries, who are really steering events. And that they, what they do is, in my experience anyway, is they tend to look for elite institutions to control the media, which has become more and more and more controlled. I mean, I could see it at the BBC in the 1990s. You could see it closing down, see good people being sacked. You could see editors intervening to stop, you know, good programs being made, that kind of thing. And this is under John Burt, who was director general at the time. And other elite institutions are, of course, the church, political parties. We mentioned Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, but what about UKIP, right? I don't imagine there's loads of UKIP fans here, but it's a perfectly legitimate idea to think, well, we might want to leave the European Union. In fact, it's the majority view in the country, apparently. And so why not have a party to do it? Now, in UKIP, you've got three main, I think Suzanne Evans, and this guy Wolf, and also another one. Well, I can't remember his name. But anyway, there were three main front runners to take over from Nigel Farage. All three of them have been told that they're not allowed to run. So you've got this PSYOP and political warfare going on in the Labour Party with Corbyn, and you've also got it going on in UKIP. What have you had in the Labour Party? The Tory Party. Well, you've had Andrea Leadsom standing against Theresa May, and then she just drops out at the last minute. So there's no real contest. You've got 150,000 paid up members of the Tory Party. I mean, anyone here? No, all right. But they've not been given any opportunity to vote because Andrea Leadsom was bullied by Murdoch. And over a weekend of being talked to by apparatchiks from the Tory Party, she was convinced that it wasn't worth standing. She wouldn't be able to be up to the job. And she stood down. So she was a sort of stalking horse. So everyone was thinking, well, maybe there's going to be a contest here. But then at the last minute, she pulled out and Theresa May is Prime Minister. Isn't that a little bit suspicious that at this particular time in history, after this Brexit vote, we've suddenly had all our three main political parties nobbled? Nobbled? So is there any real democracy? Well, the only place you're going to get real democracy when the political parties are under attack is through the media. But hang on, the mainstream media is all pretty much locked down anyway. So they can talk about ISIS night after night in these terms and get away with it. And I think, in a way, that's why... I just keep week after week doing this show in Bristol is because we've got to have at least a bit of truth out there. I've put quite a lot of time and effort over the years into trying to stay on top of this stuff. And it's really a kind of broadcasting and journalism is and writing is a bit of an act of faith, really, because you don't know who's going to read your stuff, who's going to listen to your stuff. And if it's going to be published, which often it isn't, I try and get stuff published and they go, oh, no, not interested in that. But broadcasting is much more direct. And the thing I love about it is that you can just literally, I could be chatting to one of you people and suddenly, literally in the next week, you could just be talking to, I wouldn't say the whole of Bristol listens to us, but we get a very good, you know, I'd say opinion formers. A lot of the politicians listen, you know, a lot of people listen to the show because they know that's where the stuff is happening. This thing on Friday with Nick Hayes was a national exclusive. It's the first time that Nick, the father of the LIBOR guy, has ever done a TV radio interview, and he did it on our show, which I was rather chuffed to have. Also, and just pointing out other lies, and I mean, a lot of the time it's lies of omission. Does anybody know who killed US President John F. Kennedy? Because this was a very important moment in Western history, wasn't it? I mean, the West sort of lost its soul when John F. Kennedy's head was blown off. Does anyone know? Sorry? Well, yes. The CIA were managing the whole thing. But, I mean, there's the assassin, his name is James Files. James Files was a hitman for the Chicago Mafia. And he was working with a guy called Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli. And they came down from Chicago because there was originally a plan to kill John F. Kennedy in Chicago. And he was the guy on the grassy knoll behind the picket fence. And he had a Remington Fireball, which is a kind of short rifle, very accurate, with a scope on it. And he killed Kennedy. Now... why haven't we been told? There was an article in the Daily Mail about it, actually, end of last year. Is this the guy that... yes, it is the guy, because he's confessed to it. And the reason he's confessed to it is because there's been three attempts on his life, and he doesn't really... he wants to make sure that people know before he gets killed. And also, it's a kind of life insurance for him. If his stuff is out there, at least if it's in the alternative media, and he gets killed, then, you know, that's going to be negative for the people that hired him in the first place and the people that knew about it. His confession is well worth watching on YouTube. We've been broadcasting a bit of it on Bristol, on the radio in Bristol. But he's absolutely watertight. One thing I will say about it, he was completely protected as a mafia man by the CIA, by Lyndon Johnson, who was the vice president, and by the FBI. So once you've got all these big institutions that might investigate you, protecting you, you can get away with the assassination. And the reason that Kennedy was assassinated mainly was because of his refusal to back the military's plan for the invasion of Cuba. And a lot of people were getting ready to do that, and some people then went into the Bay of Pigs and died, and there was a lot of resentment against Kennedy saying, You know, he should have helped us more. He should have provided all sorts of other cover for this invasion, and we've been successful, and these people have died. Let's kill him. And so they did. And so one of the things that James Files talks about, for example, is when he stood behind the picket fence pointing this gun and blows Kennedy's head off, he describes it very graphically. He then, one of the motorcycle outriders who's with the convoy in the famous Zapruder film, you can see him, the motorcycle outrider has obviously heard that the shot has come from over there that's killed the president or that's injured the president. They didn't know he was dead at the time. He hops off his bike or his motorbike, starts running up with a gun, right, a pistol, towards the guy that's killed him. Now, two guys step out in front of... You see, he was given protection, right? He had two guys in front of him that stepped out with Secret Service passes and said, no, the shot didn't come from over here. Go back on your bike, yeah? We're Secret Services. So he didn't have to do anything. He had a kind of defensive wall of Secret Service people between him and the president. Now, the reason people say, don't they, don't go on about the Kennedy assassination, but it is crucial because it is the point at which the Nazi faction in the United States and the Dulles brothers and Prescott Bush, the Bush's grandfather, these people were definitely fascists. They were cooperating with the Nazis. They knew at the end of the Second World War the Nazis had a lot of money and that they needed safe passage, so they did deals at the end of the war with them. So, okay, you know, come over here. And also, we like your technology. We like the fact that you know how to get rid of communists, that you've got all the names of various communist spies and people like that. So there was a dirty deal done between the Allies at the end of the war with the Nazis, quite clearly. And a financial empire, in a way, created clandestine financial empire. But we're not really getting a lot about that on the BBC. We get a few little bits and pieces. I don't know how much time have I got? About 10 minutes. Well, look, shall I just throw it open to questions? And maybe we'll start with you, because you wanted to say something about ISIS, didn't you? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, hi. I think it wasn't a deliberate creation of ISIS. The way you worded it there, I took it that what you were trying to put across was they were a deliberate, manufactured enemy. And I think... they have been manufactured, possibly. I can see how they've been manufactured, but I don't think it was a deliberate... I think it was more of a creation of stupidity, really, rather than deliberate, conscious
decision.
This is
Michael
decision.
Flynn's point, was it's a willful decision. We went to the White House, to the Pentagon, and said, don't do this, because if you do, there's going to be a... You know, this group is going to form in Syria and Iraq. There is another side to all of this, which is the 1983 Yinon Plan. Now, how many people here have heard of the Yinon Plan? You go and have a look at it online. It's absolutely fascinating. It's an Israeli general, General Yinon. He said, what we need to do is to balkanize the Middle East. What we need to do is break up these states that are around us, and we need to have a kind of, you know, failed states around Israel, then we can expand. They were looking particularly at places like the Golan Heights, which has oil, which the Israelis... It's not Israeli territory, but they're already trying to... Genie Oil, Dick Cheney's company, is trying to exploit oil in the Golan Heights, and they're drilling, you know, now, even though it's not their country. And so that's another aspect of what's going on in the Middle East, is it's a US-British-Israeli plan to literally to just get those Arabs out of the way so we can expand, take over the natural resources. And that, of course, is a potential fuse for what we're talking about with ISIS, which is a kind of religious war. Right, so you get all the Muslims joining the ISIS and all this kind of thing against the Israelis. And the whole point there really is to get poor people fighting each other, isn't it? Isn't that what they love to do? Race wars in the United States. We've had even back in the 1960s with the Sharon Tate murders, if people know about that stuff, there were attempts, because this was Charles Manson kind of going into Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate's house and just murdering people, yeah? These big famous filmmakers and actresses, actors and actresses. Along the wall were daubed anti-white slogans. Even though it was white people that did it, there was a definite attempt in those days to try and get a race war going. They're trying to do the same to a certain extent, I think, in the US now, by having these, like, basically saying to the police, well, just kill as many black people as you want and nothing will happen to you. In fact, we've got a situation in Britain, haven't we, with impunity by police. Okay, so the police kill somebody, there's a whole load of whatever inquests, etc., and nothing happens. It's just like, you know, when you're a policeman, you can do almost anything. And what is most worrying about that is that we've now, just this last week, had the announcement of loads more armed police in London. They're going to stop a terrorist attack, are they? Are they going to stop some guy driving a truck into a crowd with a gun if they happen to be there? I don't really get this. It looks much more to me like a kind of police state as a reaction, in a way, to the crimes abroad that Britain's been doing with people like Tony Blair, Alistair Campbell, and Lord Faulkner, by the way, who was the one who altered the evidence to Parliament about the whether the war was legal or not. And he is one of the coup plotters against Corbyn. You know, so this, you know, it all starts to come together with the Corbyn is the one they're most afraid of, because he could put Lord Faulkner and Tony Blair in jail if he becomes Prime Minister, and if he starts speaking out about that. I think, what they're most afraid of. If you've got a criminal elite, they have to be worked together to make sure one of them is in charge. And I think we are a situation now where we have got a criminal elite running the country. And of course, the other thing they don't want is, they don't want people like me having a large audience in the national media to tell people, explain to people this kind of stuff that's going on. Anyway, any more thoughts? Yeah.
Hi, thanks. Talking about ISIS and, you know, before that, the invasion of Iraq, invasion of Afghanistan, the war on terror, 9/11. I wonder if you've had any discussions about 9/11 on your radio show, or is the dirty term conspiracy theorists, make sure that you just don't go there as well?
Yeah, it goes back to the JFK assassination, that term conspiracy theory, right? Because there was a lot of very good research. He just died a couple of months ago. Mark Lane was one of the first. He knew Kennedy quite well, and he was a lawyer that wrote some of the first books about what the conspiracy was really all about. And this term conspiracy theorist was invented by the CIA in the States to put out through the mainstream, CBS, NBC, and all the rest of them, to try and deflect from all of the truth that was being told about how inadequate the Warren Commission was into the Kennedy assassination, some of the interests of people who were on the Warren Commission. So they just, you know, there's actually a document out there you can find online, which is, this is the where they said, look, this is conspiracy theory. We need to use this term, get it out to the press, and use it to attack and try and discredit anyone that's telling the truth about Kennedy. But 9/11, well, I'm with a couple of other people, edit something called the 9/11 Forum, which is, we discuss all sorts of stuff on there. I mean, everything, pretty much. And nothing is, you know, anything that's of political interest or propaganda interest. I mean, for example, the Turkish coup, there's loads of people discussing that. And I'm the editor of that. So it's 911forum.org.uk. But yes, 9/11 is the big lie, isn't it? Is 9/11 a big lie?
Get on the radio on your station?
Well, we do regularly. A few weeks ago, we had a guy, and if anyone wants to get the kind of real dope on 9/11, there's a terrific book called 9/11, The New Evidence. Well, it's a guy called Ian Henshaw wrote, and it's been revised as well. It's really good. It's got pictures in, as well as not too much text, and it's a tiny little book. I actually gave 10 copies of it to a contact of mine in the army. And he said he went round Whitehall to all the top people, and he put a copy on each of them's desk saying, whatever you do, don't read that. It's a terrific, it's a really good, you know, sort of the basic stuff about the lies of 9/11. I mean, the number one, I suppose, has got to be, how does the most powerful and effective air force in the world allow these planes to just fly around at random without intercepting them? I mean, this is a normal thing. If an airliner gets hijacked, within minutes you've got a little tornado sitting next to it if it happens above our heads here. So they're letting these planes just fly around. I mean, another aspect to it, of course, is the collapse of Building 7. I mean, this is starting to, you know, if anyone hasn't looked into this is, you know, but it's, we're being lied to about Bin Laden in a cave in Afghanistan causing that. Okay, any more thoughts?
Can I, Tony, speak? What's interesting is that we've come to the point now where we realise, or a lot of people are waking up to the fact that we're part of a grand illusion that has been happening for possibly 1,000 years, where there's been, everything's been manipulated. And now we've got all the information at our fingertips. Amazingly enough, right now we could all get up and we can see the answer to any question we want, which is on the end of our, you know, most of our phones. And this 9/11 is the most important. It was a world-changing action that happened, and I think it was it's the fundamental bottom rung of the ladder. And to me, we want, you know, we're sitting here. It's so depressing listening to the manipulation. And what we want is we want, you know, not you, Tony. But what we want is we want a revolution. We are part of a revolution. The revolution is happening here at the Green Gathering, and it's expanding, which is wonderful. But the most important thing is that if we can get to the truth of 9/11 out to the 99%, and there is the pressure put on with people like Avaz to reopen the investigation, there's nothing they can do about it. It's a can of worms, and it will undermine the establishment and completely turn the world over. So for me, that seems to be, you know, we're all looking for the changeover, you know, and for me that is a fundamental for changing the world.
Okay, let's good, really good points. So don't want to be too depressing. You're absolutely right. There's loads of positive stuff to talk about, really. One is, because we're not watching the London media, a lot of people are using social media, particularly young people don't believe a lot of what they're being told. And this has become a culture, particularly amongst youngsters. Oh, you don't believe that, do you? And I remember when we were, you know, teenagers, we were pretty sceptical about the older generation who'd left this messed up world for us, you know. So that's a really positive sign. The other thing is, this will be precipitated in the future. This, you know, this raising of consciousness and of people getting more organised. I mean, we do it with squatting and homelessness in Bristol week after week, but it's for those people that get housed, it's a brilliant experience. You know, it really is fantastic. And what will precipitate it will be financial crunch, because this system cannot carry on. It'll be either war or whatever will precipitate it. Maybe it'll just be, they'll say it's Brexit that's caused the whole financial crash. But that will start to really, really make people think about what's important in their lives. And I think that will be like a fire under people's arses, basically. Like, right, we can't just kind of carry on. In a way, what's happened is our evil that we've been doing around the world in places like Yemen right this minute and in Iraq is coming back home slowly, because the rulers are, okay, so they start by fighting people abroad, and then they realise the people at home don't support them anymore, don't believe them anymore. So they have to use the same sort of tactics against people at home. So I guess that's... I don't want to wind up quite a second, because there is one wonderful little book which I came across recently, which is called Heralding Article 25, A People's Strategy for World Transformation. I know nothing about Mohamed Mashabi, who wrote it, but this is the future. At the end of the Second World War, people sat down and they thought, right, what should real human rights be and what should they look like? And this is Article 25 of the UN Convention of Human Rights, which is all about the right to water, the right to food, the right to somewhere to live. I mean, there are all sorts of other rights that spin off from those, but Article 25 is the core of what we really should be focusing on, I think. And that will bring the Corbynistas and the Greens and everybody together right across the planet to transform it into a place where we can, you know, live with self-respect and respecting other people without this kind of bully faction. And maybe I could finish really by just saying the one of the most fantastic movements are the Veterans for Peace, people who have fought in war, they've been there, etc., SAS, SBS, infantry, etc., and they're coming together and say it's all a load of rubbish. As Smedley Butler said, it's a racket, and let's call it out as such. So thanks everyone for listening.
Brilliant. Hope you enjoyed. Yeah, round of applause for Tony, that's great. Okay, I'm pretty sure that Tony will be happy to take more questions outside if you haven't had a chance to have your question. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, okay.
What radio station?
Yes, it's really Bristol quickly. Community FM, BCFM, and you'll find us the show. You can download podcasts, listen in the car or while you're jogging or whatever you do, at thisweek.org.uk. Thisweek.org.uk.
Brilliant.
And you can find us having a row every week.
Cool. Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Tony.